The thing that I find interesting in reading this book, and I can imagine having worked with around a few artists and how temperamental they can be and everything,
life.
That you probably needed every ounce of faith you had to be able to deal with some of these people.
That's right. Each one is different. You know, each one wants to be handled different, you know. And you have to be supportive as a technician, you know. It's a man has to face a concert, which is not easy, you know. And yeah, and I never lost the joy of working on a good Steinway and bring it into its best, you know, performing condition, and then to hear it performed by great artists. That is my joy, you know, boys. Yeah, I love it.
I found it also interesting as I read about the building of the piano.
Right.
I can imagine that working on a Steinway as opposed to working on some of the mass-produced pianos would be the same as for a mechanic working on a Jaguar instead of a Chevy.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It takes about a year before Steinway gets together, you know. And I believe Steinway is only possible in America, you know. We are not like Yamaha, where, and you have to admire what the Japanese do, you know. I mean, the pianos, they are so the same. Each one is so, you know, you could take an action out of a Yamaha piano and put it in the next same model, of course, and it fits completely, never with a Steinway. We are much too much individualists, you know, although, of course, we have our regulations and our measurements and to go by, you know, to build a piano. Yet to a certain extent, you know, that all the artisans which work on the piano in the course of that year to put it together, puts to a certain degree its own creativity in, resulting in a piano where you don't find two Steinways alike. You know, each one is different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's marvelous because we are all different, you know, and especially the artists, each one that hears a little bit different or has different or feels different, you know, playing the piano. It's not so uniform, you know, like the mass-produced instrument, which is absolutely marvelous. For instance, I worked with Horowitz. I was his piano tuner for a lifetime, from 1962 until he died in 89. But Horowitz would have never been able to Rubinstein Steinway or vice versa, you know. He needed an entirely different
piano. I noticed that in your book, that Horowitz liked his action very light, didn't he?
Extremely light, boys, yeah. You could almost blow on it and the key would go down, you know, this kind of thing. And Rubinstein would have never been able to manage an action like this. He needed to put it in gram weights, Horowitz action would go down with 45 gram touch weight, you know, to push the key down. And the uplift of the key was tremendous. So it stays right under your fingers when you thrilled or whatever, played. And Rubinstein could have never handled an action like this. If you gave him an action which was 20 grams more, 60, 65 grams, you know, putting down the key, that... And I'm not saying that one was greater than the other. I'm only stressing the fact that we are all different, you know.
But it's interesting that even though you would not be putting one above the other, that you didn't dare mention the name of Rubinstein in the presence of
Horowitz.
No,
you don't do that. You never, never.
And if you mentioned anybody else, you had to tell him still how wonderful he was.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to be very careful. You have to be a diplomat, you know. And with this, I never mentioned the name of Rubinstein, you know, in the presence of Horowitz or vice versa, you know. If they ask you about, you know, another artist, you have to be very careful what you say. You have to be a diplomat, you know. Not to lie, but you have to be a diplomat.
Everything seems to come back to Horowitz since you spent most of your life with him.
Exactly. With Horowitz, in comparison to the other artists, with Horowitz I did all the tuning and all the traveling and preparing the piano for all his concerts since from 1962 until he died. He died November 5th in 89. Now, with Rubinstein was a little bit different. Usually I would only go to the most important places or concerts with Rubinstein, and he wouldn't care if he had another tuner somewhere playing in a high school or wherever, you know.
Horowitz probably would never have played
in high school.
No,
he never did. No, he never did. That's right.
Which is why I was surprised when I saw this recording come out, that live and unedited, that he would, or anyone would, allow this to be released with all of the warts and everything still on it. That surprised me a great deal.
You know what happened? It's a silent years, 13 years he didn't play in the public. Mm-hmm. And yesterday, you know, I got this this question. He said, Franz, what did you do in the time? He said, we were very busy. We did a lot of recording sessions, you know, which I would turn the pages for him. And he didn't release, I don't know, hardly anything of those years. But after his death, you know, and Wanda Toscanini, his wife, Wanda Toscanini, mm-hmm. always, she allowed it, you know, let our producer, Tom Frost, who was his producer for many years, he's coming out more and more of that stuff, which we did in those years.
I have a huge rack in our library that's just nothing but all of these new releases.
That's right.
But it's marvelous. It's when you hear studio sessions and things that you have not heard before, it gives you a different perspective on an artist.
Right. That's right. And he was very good in recording session, boys. He would not split, you know, even the whole take was no good. And he would play the piece again all over, you know, but not like many artists, you know, with a insert 8, take 5 or whatever, you know. Insert take 10, you know, take 48, you know.
I see a lot of that.
I've seen that.
They spend
you know,
more time.
And finally, an artist said, that's the best I can do. I'm sorry. You know?
Well, if you can't reproduce it on the stage, then there's a real danger in putting it on a recording, even though I'm sure a lot of artists say, but this is going to be around long after I'm gone.
Right.
I want it to be perfect. Right. But if you couldn't deliver it, then what do you do?
There's nothing perfect. There's absolutely not, you know. And even with Horowitz, he had unfailing fingers, you know. And when I think of Maurizio Pollini, as the one I still tune for, you know, I do his American tour, I don't hear a wrong note. And yet Horowitz could play a few. And he was funny about this. He would come off the stage and he would say, Franz, what do you think? Not bad for an old man, you know. But a few wrong notes, he would speak German to me then, he said, and paar falsche Noten. He said, that's fine, Maestro, that's fine. It's live recording. So you belong a few, right?
And most of the people are never going to know if they're right or wrong anyway. They're so
you are so right.
As you said, they would be sitting on the edge of their seats, and there's such an electricity in a performance.
That's right. You don't.
They're
even
caught up in the event.
Exactly. And especially with Rubinstein, he could play with great conviction, quite a few notes wrong, you know. But he communicated music in such a way, you know, you didn't even hear them. You know what I mean? Wonderful, we call it in German, Ausstrahlung. Fantastic, I don't know, Ausstrahlung. Fantastic rapport, you know, connection to the public.
As we say in the radio business, if you're going for us, if you mispronounce something, mispronounce it with conviction.
Absolutely. You must do that with great conviction.
And they'll think, oh, did you hear how he did that? He must have thought this was better. I would like to know a little bit more about Rubinstein, because his performance of the Rachmaninoff Concerto No. 2 was the very first classical recording I ever recall hearing. I ran across a copy of this in my parents' closet when I was growing up.
Yeah, right.
And I always remembered the opening bars of that second concerto.
Yeah.
And then later on, it never really hit for me until I saw President Nixon going to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Moscow.
Right.
And they played that opening portion of that as he walked up to place the wreath. And that piece of music just was forever right there. But I always hear Rubinstein playing it.
And this is something, a sound which you never get out of your ears. You have it, you know. Certain concerts and certain pieces, you know, I have them locked into my ears, you know. You never forget it, you know. And Rubinstein, oh my goodness, he communicated music. He was marvelous, you know. But let me tell you this, I was extremely nervous to tune for Rubinstein for a simple reason. I tuned for many of the artists. I was a concert piano tuner in Germany, you know. Many of the artists I tuned there before, Alicia de la Roche or you know, Shura Tchaikovsky and all those people. But I've never tuned for Rubinstein. I came to America, you know, and had to take over this responsibility from Bill Hupfer, my predecessor. And I was very nervous. You know, I knew what Rubinstein, of course, Jewish, he never would perform in Germany, you know. So can you imagine? I was very nervous to me. But he was very, very nice. We became very good friends. And even in later years, to the point that it didn't even dawn on me at the moment, he had sworn that he never will use the German language again. But in later years, in a dressing room, alone with him, all of a sudden he slipped into German, you know, and spoke German to me.
And a sign of extreme relaxation.
Yeah, it was wonderful. He was wonderful with people, you know, he loved people and communicated music. That's what he did, you know, Rubinstein.
That's what I noticed as I was reading about him, that, and I've noticed this with other artists, most of the time what I've seen is that it is the lesser light an artist is, the more difficult he can be many times to deal with. And Rubinstein must have been very secure in his talents because he would talk to anybody.
Absolutely. He would stop for anyone in the street, you know, who would stop and would get an autograph, you know. I told the story last night, you know. There was Rubinstein. We were in, usually that wouldn't happen because his wife traveled with him. But when his wife was not with him, after concerts, then we would go out together for dinner late at night, you know. But we are in Pittsburgh, only to tell you the story, you know, the way he was with people. We are in Pittsburgh, and after the concert, you know, we are sitting together at the Hilton Hotel and in a restaurant and having dinner late at night. And there comes an American pilot, you know, full dress. He comes to the table and all excited to see Maestro, I'm just coming from the airport, you know, I didn't come to your concert, but I'm so excited to see you here. You must know I have all your recordings, whatever you did. And so Rubinstein said to him, he said, where are you? Yeah, well, I'll sit over there. Are you alone? He said, yes. He said, and then he arranged that the waiter brought all his stuff over to our table. And the guy had a ball, you know, to meet Rubinstein, you know, and then so close by, to, you know, and
probably
talking.
Couldn't eat.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Excited, yeah. Well, that's the way he was.
And yet, and I can't imagine, having read what I have, that Horowitz would even have, well, he probably would even have looked the man in the eye, possibly, but never invite him to the table.
No. Never with Horowitz. People would stop him in the street, you know, wanted an autograph or whatever, you know. And he would just walk on, you know. One guy, never forget, in Philadelphia, you know, he has to play a concert. And the guy wouldn't give up. He said, Meister, but I come to your concert tonight. Good for you. And he kept right on walking.